Everyone, this evening to a new series on the precepts, and I'm it never thunders in this city. To open our preceptual talk, we have the heavens at our beckoning. So it's actually it's an extremely important series, and was thought of actually when I talked to Eric Kolvig a couple of years ago. He had just left his Santa Fe Sangha, and he said he had spent something like, I can't quite remember, but something like 6 months doing nothing but talking about the precepts. I said, this gang here would never. But I thought I would give it a try for this series, because it's an extremely important part of Buddhism and our spiritual lives, and we really must be very deeply based in the precepts to understand and to even have a foundation on which to be able to practice. In fact, the Buddha was once asked what he taught, and he said he taught three things and three things only. He taught wisdom, panya. He taught steadiness of mind, which he called samadhi, and he taught ethical conduct, which he called sila. So sila, panya, and samadhi are the a triple reference for his particular teaching, his body of teaching. And it's important that those three go hand in hand. They're like a single twined rope, that all three threads are the teaching. And you can't just say, well, I go straight to wisdom and continue to do whatever I do every day unethically. It doesn't work like that. It brings us all into this basis of ethical conduct if we practice it, and the other strands are dependent upon it. In one of the Dhammapada verses, the Dhammapada being some of the older sayings of the Buddha, it said, the fragrance of flowers or sandalwood blows only with the prevailing wind, but the fragrance of virtue pervades all directions. So it's not just for us that we do this, and for the level of stillness and quietude which inevitably an ethical life leads to, but also for the very basis of how we are in our relationships with other beings. So precepts, extraordinarily important. So tonight I'll give an overview of the five precepts, and then each week I will open a new precept up as a talk in and of itself. And tonight, before we leave after the talk, for those who would like to, I thought I would chant the refuges and the precepts both in Pali and in English. And if you'd like to take them formally in the traditional manner that they're offered, you'll have the opportunity to do that. And I'll hand out sheets so that you can follow along in the tradition. And then I'll also offer some opportunities to go even further than the five precepts, if you'd like. There are other possibilities, up to eight precepts that sometimes lay people take. And although they may not fit your particular lifestyle, you can challenge yourself to take perhaps one additional precept, if you'd like, in the course of this time together. So it's both an opportunity to investigate what sila or perceptual or ethical life might be at its base, and also subtle ways that we infract or make infractions on those precepts and rationalize our so doing. And they're also an opportunity to look in a closer way at challenging ourselves and pushing ourselves perhaps just slightly in terms of a resolve for some additional points in the course of these weeks. It's just listening to the rain. Just allowing that sense of ease to come. Because the precepts are very much about that sense of ease of well-being. And I'll go through a whole number of points tonight about the benefits of the precepts, but basically it's about the lightness and ease that comes so easily when we listen to nature. It's said that the Buddha originated the precepts when he reflected on the qualities of an awakened heart. And it's so important from the beginning that we see where the precepts come from, that they come from the qualities of an awakened being rather than from a moral charge, from a moral reference that mostly we look upon ourselves in terms of shoulds and should nots. That's really counterindicated in the precepts. It's adharmic to use the precepts in terms of shame and guilt, much as most of us do in terms of the Ten Commandments. This is not a talk about being a saint. It's a talk about wise view. Because when we're aligned, when we are in alignment with seeing connection in the world and moving and operating and working towards that end to be more interconnected with ourselves and with other people, then the precepts are the path for that to unfold. And when we stray off of that path, then we see that what we're doing is being selfish and greedy. And that's an indication that we're no longer operating in accordance to the deeper heart yearning of connectedness. So it's extremely important not to think about this. And if you do, I would just put the precepts down because it will work against you. You know, I once, if my early science holds, I remember an experiment that a light beam that enters water is refracted in some way. It means it changes angles. When the precepts enter the mind, it often changes angles. It's meant to be a calling or an array of what an awakened mind is like, but when it enters the mind, and skewed by our unwise view, a sense of I, me, and mine, it becomes a call for shame and remorse and guilt, which just feeds our whole embodiment of self. And the precepts, if they're anything, are more like the electric wires that we place around a barnyard, so that if the stray animal runs into the electric wire, it buzzes the animal enough so that they know to stay within the lines of the pasture. So too, the precepts, when we find ourselves breaking them, are painful. You can feel the pain of breaking a precept. And the pain can be recognized as having strayed off into the realms of selfishness and dislike and anger. So to keep the precepts is to keep ourselves within the lane of our own growth. And I think it's best remembered that way. So it doesn't really matter what our background has been in terms of our moral uprightness. It doesn't matter what your history has been. It doesn't matter what you bring to this moment as we enter this field of preceptual life. It's not about that. In fact, one of the most often quoted stories of the Buddha is about Angulimala. Angulimala means literally a necklace of thumbs. And it's, I don't know if this is true or not, it's pretty far out there, but it's said that this bandit or outlaw at the time of the Buddha had a necklace of thumbs of the people he killed. and he had 499 thumbs on his necklace. And he wanted to reach 500, so he's looking over the landscape, and he sees his mother, and he says, well, I'll kill my mother. The Buddha, in his psychic power, realized that this man was about to kill his mother, and that, in Buddhism, is one of the most heinous acts you can do. So he materialized in front of this man, and the outlaw, Angulimala, changed directions from pursuing his mother, I guess, to pursuing the Buddha. And the Buddha, with his psychic powers, stood still, and yet the distance between Angulimala and the Buddha didn't decrease. And so the bandit cries out, stop, Buddha, stop. And the Buddha says, I have stopped. And at that point, it said that the outlaw fell to his knees, sobbing, and asked for ordination. And the Buddha took him in. And it said that when he would go on alms round, this bandit would get stoned and he'd come back all bloody, and even though he's a monk, because he wasn't well liked in the village. And the Buddha said, better here than in the next world that his punishment be received. So I don't know anything about that, but it's best here that we put our past beside it, down, and just take up this mantle of perceptual life, of ethical life. Let's just do it. I have been in scenes in which the precepts were not encouraged, spiritual groups in which precepts were not encouraged, and there was all kinds of funny business going on, often between the teacher and his or her students, as well as just a kind of unboundedness, kind of a reckless heart within the students themselves. There was no sense of safety. And I have said this many times, that the Sangha is built on safety. If it's built on anything, it's built on the fact that there can be a trusting relationship, a growing trusting relationship between us, so that we're all, at least nominally, attempting to move our lives in more wholesome and beneficial ways. And even though there may be regressions on that, that's okay. It's okay. We look at the mistakes and we move on. But the point is that we're not using our lives for manipulation and exploitation. That it is being governed by the principles of a wholeheartedness and an honesty. And so when we come together as a group, there can be greater sense of trust for each other. Now, none of us are ever going to be able to show ourselves in front of another person or be able to dialogue about the areas that we feel are the most difficult that we hold unless we feel that safety. So the whole sense of safety embodied by the Sangha moves everyone's ability towards sincerity and honesty to a higher degree. It's not a small thing that we do, but it depends upon all of us doing it and walking those lines. I was a monk once, and one of the other Westerners who ordained with me didn't have a very solid background in ethics. And his mind, even though he was in robes, his mind kept playing upon the unethical lifestyle that he had led and what he would like to do in terms of unethical behavior then and there. But his robes prevented it. When you take the Buddhist ordination, you have 243 precepts to follow. They govern every aspect of everything you do, and if you do it with any kind of sincerity at all, you can't get away with a thing. And this guy kept saying to me, I can't believe the power of sila. I can't believe it, because it contained him. It kept him from just following his conditioned way of exploitation and manipulation. And another person would look upon those precepts as kind of being a sense of confinement. But it's not confinement at all. They just put you into the rules of an awakened being's heart. And then you have to keep bumping up against the electric fence of your own greed, which keeps you in line with the view and the walking of the awakened ones. You see? So the precepts are meant to open the field of awareness to freedom, but they remind us of how much greed still runs in us through our conditioning. So as lay people, we're just going to take five of them. Just going to take five of them. Not 243. And work with them. And work with them with sincerity, hopefully, with integrity. And say, okay, this one's a hard one for me, you know. And when we get to speech or when we get to whatever, we keep falling off that. And we have to look honestly about what it is, what it is and how it is that we're distorting our reality, how we're trying to create a myth about ourselves or a lie about ourselves in order to obtain whatever it is that we're trying to attain through breaking the precept. And so the precepts are really a call back to stillness. And we find that breaking the precept is just following the usual conditioned noise of the mind, and that the precept is a call back to being simple. Call to back to being simple. And remember, they're framed to undertake the training. Each precept starts off to undertake the training I refrain from. It's a training. We're not looking for perfection. I undertake the training. To refrain from. I love that. Because when we refrain from something, there's a pause. We aren't immediately going into something. We're pausing before we do it. The pause allows us to consider other options, other opportunities. So the precepts are an opportunity to put a space between our immediate conditioned reaction towards killing or stealing or lying or whatever, and to pause and bring forth a fuller consideration on the subject. It doesn't say thou shalt not, which means that it may be appropriate to lie or to kill or to steal or to whatever, depending upon. In fact, a friend of mine did a psychological test with some of the well-known evolved yogis internationally. And one of the questions was, if your child was hungry, would you steal bread? And many of these great, well-practiced yogis said, yes, of course. Of course I would. You see, it's not always about obeying the law. It's looking at the situation, pausing, seeing what is needed, what's going on, and bringing forth the totality of our clarity and then acting from the clarity. That's Buddhism. Buddhism is not a flow chart about how to correctly be and live your life. It's not, you know, if I do this, then I must do that. It's not that. What it is a call to greater clarity. And from that greater clarity, we can then make our minds up as to what needs to be done through intelligence and a more refined sense of sensitivity and contact than usually our selfishness allows. So I know in the last few weeks you've had some precepts talks by Arena. And so we have a lot of this for the next couple of months. And I hope you really take it to heart, because it will challenge you if you do it. It will genuinely challenge your spiritual practice, because none of us who are less than fully awakened don't have many infractions. Many of us have infractions on these, perhaps on every one of them. And we're just, okay, let's just tuck it in a little bit here. Let me see what's going on there. Let me make a discovery as to see why I'm doing this unskillful behavior from every single time. So for the householder, We're providing a safe container for your family, for yourself, for your neighbors. That safety is bred through the five precepts. So let's go down and look at how the five precepts work. And how will it allow us to come to a deeper sense of our spiritual lives, an unfolding of our spiritual understanding? So the first is, I've explained partially, it allows us to see when wise view is operating. It is a warning light for unwise view. And I think wise view, if there were one part of the Buddhist teaching, I think, that frames all other aspects, it's wise view. Many of us take off or take out suttas, kind of at random, and read them. And the suttas sometimes contain information or instructions on how to live. And these instructions, if not understood in terms of the embodiment of the teaching of all of Buddhism, can be seen as kind of good and bad, evil and being good. That, to me, is not very good dharma. I think that in pulling out random suttas and reading them, we do ourselves a disservice, unless we have a very deep and profound understanding of the whole range of Buddhism and how all of the Buddha's teaching is structured around the Eightfold Path. And the first line of the Eightfold Path is wise view. Okay, that life isn't about I, me, and mine. We have misperceived it in some way. It's about how to connect and interconnect, and to find the truer relationship to things rather than the relationship of individuality and separation. And we have to work in body, speech, and mind in order to uncover or rediscover that sense of connection. And the precepts are the first basis for that to happen. Unless we establish the linkage in action and speech through perceptual life, through ethical life, that interconnectedness will never be known. Because you can't lie and cheat and steal and then expect your heart to open to the other person. And it's only when you are ethical that our hearts are felt in an integrated way and open to that kind of insight. And unless our actions accompany that insight, the insight, the samadhi, this panya, the wisdom, will not be there. So you begin to see, it's just a whole different thing than what I heard from the Christian teaching. I personally don't believe that the Ten Commandments are different than the five precepts, but I think that they're taught very differently. I never heard the wisdom behind the Ten Commandments, because I don't think the people who were teaching them had much practice experience. So here we bring the wisdom of insight and the embodiment of the Buddha's teaching in order to really access the deeper understanding of what this means. And there's an increased reverence through wise view, an increased reverence, and perhaps some of you have already felt it, of just the reverence towards life, increased reverence towards all facets of life. We're not so quick to extinguish life because it's not helping us, because that spider has no business in my... We aren't so quick to do that anymore. Hopefully, the practice begins to awaken that sense of value of life. That's the first indication. There are two indications. That's one of the indications that wise view is operating. The second indication is that generally we don't want to harm someone anymore. The need, the will, the conditioned reflex to harm isn't there. And I think that's the where the practice is actually beginning to integrate into our lives, when we're not immediately called to harm or berate or condemn or exploit or manipulate. And that's why the rain is important. Because if you're sensitive enough to feel the quality of the rain, then the heart is open sufficiently to that reverence. And so when we listen to it, you feel the stillness come in. Doesn't that stillness hold the very fabric of being together? From this point, from this vantage point, why would one lie? Why would one steal? Why would one do that? It doesn't make any sense. From the perspective of stillness, you see how the precepts intimate that stillness. Secondly, the precepts allow for a lightness of mind, buoyancy, a buoyant mind. We're so heavy and laden with tension and tightness, with anger. Think of the mind states that many of us carry, retaliation and brutality and angst, and how heavy and how burning those mind states are. And most of them are because we have cultivated that sense of selfishness, that sense of, I'll get back, retaliation. And so fostering a different mode of inner relationships allows the alleviation of this burden. Now, for those of you who are practiced, you know that lightness of mind is essential for attention and focus. If our minds are not quiet, gentle, focusing is almost impossible. It's just discursive. It's just, oh, it's just distraught thinking. It's okay. So that we begin to feel the effects of the actions of the precepts on our very mental frame of reference, our very mind, the very mind itself. And suddenly, focusing becomes a lot easier. Attention, samadhi, steadiness of mind becomes much more available to us. Thirdly, perceptual life, following the five precepts, limits paranoia and allows an upright posture. You know, I don't know about you, but I was always sneaky when I was a kid. And with a family of five kids, stealing the cookies in the cookie jar and all of that, I did it. But there was always this kind of turning around feeling like somebody was about to catch me into something. And that followed me well into adulthood, actually. Even when the behavior ceased, just if I knew something had gone wrong in the environment and I hadn't even done it, I still felt like I was about to be caught. It goes for a long time. However, feeling that you might be caught and knowing that you didn't do anything is very different than feeling that you might get caught and having done something. And when you can hold the feeling of paranoia, but you have the integrity, knowing that you haven't done anything, then it's okay. I can feel that. It's very clear that that's from the past. So the precepts begin to show us the past pressure on the moment. Does that make sense? I was in the monastery, and I was helping a friend of mine do something that was very important, and get a snake out of his hut or something. I can't remember what it was, but we were always doing that kind of thing. And the bell rang for us all to meet for this festival where the lay people were coming and offering food. And when the bell rung, you got there. The last thing in the world you'd want to be is late to a ceremony like that, especially if you're a Westerner, because everybody was always watching the Westerners anyway. So anyway, the snake was, I don't remember what it was, but it was, we were involved in something and we couldn't get away, and the bell rang, and 10 or 15 minutes later we finally got whatever it was out of the hut. And so my friend and I are walking, and you can't walk fast as a monk, you're walking slow, to this area where hundreds of lay people were, and all the monks were in the semicircle, and here we come, and I'm going, oh my God, this is the most embarrassing moment of my life. And I was saying, oh, I can't feel so bad. How could we have done this? And my friend looks over to me, and he says something I'll never forget. He says, "You have absolutely nothing to be ashamed of whatsoever. You helped me, and it was your heart. You did what your heart needed to do. This, we're late, and we owe no apologies to anyone." And all of a sudden, even though the attention from everybody didn't decrease, and I felt their steel-cutting stares, I could hold it, because I knew. You just know. The precept, you see? You just know. You did what you needed to do. Yeah, you don't owe an apology. You needed to go up and tell the Ajahn afterwards why you were late, but it wasn't apologetically. It wasn't. And he said, fine. Because you know, and there was no question about lying, you just don't do that. You see the beauty of that? When things aren't questioned, because everybody moves according to that integration, that integrity of spirit. Now, a couple of years ago, I was in Kansas City offering a course, and the person who picked me up for the course, to take me to the course, was a man who had just gotten out of prison after 22 years. And he was in a hyper frenetic state. And we were driving, he was just shaking, and so I was asking him about his nervousness, and he said, oh, that came during the 22 years. He says every time he would go out to the activity yard as a prisoner, he would have to prepare himself because he was going to be challenged. He was a very small man, and I guess his size, people challenged him or something, but he'd have to prepare. He'd stand in front of the mirror, and he would just get ferocious in front of the mirror, and he would just start swinging, get himself in a rage, and then he would go out to the activity yard because that's the only way he could carry himself in the bearing that he needed in order to stay alive in this prison. 22 years of that. So now he's in the Dharma. He's found his way to the insight meditation. And every morning he says he gets up and he's going to some very innocent and benign job, like being a janitor in an elementary school or something. I don't know what it was. Something like that. And he's got the same fear and trepidation. And he stands in front of the mirror and he says, I'm not going out to the yard today. I'm not going out to the yard. Feel this in your heart. And I said, you know you're not going out into the yard today. You're not. And you never will again. And every day you stand in front of that mirror, you know your proper place and thing. You feel the earth under you. And those years are now past you. And you look right in that mirror and you know that. And that feeling may accompany you. Those thoughts may be right with you. But you are not going out into that yard again. And you never will. You're moving into a different area of yourself. A different quality of softness and integrity. And so the feelings of the past aren't going to diminish right away. But what it is that there's a griddle on. And for 22 years, that griddle was plugged in. Now the griddle's on, and you've unplugged the griddle. It'll be hot for a long time, but it's decreasing in heat every single day. That's what we have to face. That's how we stand and hold ourselves. With the integrity and the discipline that's needed, knowing that that's behind us. Okay, there are very few people in this room who don't have a series of confessions and guilts that heavy their spirit. Okay, that's it. That's gone now. There's nothing you can do about that. We're standing in front of the mirror. This is a new day. And the integrity is there for all of us. Let us not forget that. Or we just get burdened by the shame of the past. Perceptual life is knowing that. When we live the precepts, we know that that's in the past. Okay? And I may be transgressions or may be mistakes making. That's okay. I can work with mistakes. And from that, we offer the fifth benefit of the precepts, and that's a gift of non-harm. A gift of non-harm. Think of it, a gift of non-harm. Every person you meet, you're making a statement through body, speech, and mind that you have nothing to fear from me. What a statement to make in this day and age. You have nothing to fear from me. I'm not going to exploit you, manipulate you. The sixth benefit, and this is a little more abstract, is that we guard against the creation of unwholesome karma. We don't spend a lot of time talking about that because it's so subjective, so ethereal in some way. But in fact, the unskillful things we do have a recourse. We have to bear under that recourse. Much of what our life is about has been because of the ways that we have been in the past. And we can clean this out more and more by just following a standard of wholesomeness, lightness of being, of non-harm. It's really letting everything be just as it is, not doing anything to gain advantage. And in so doing, we'd allow everything and everyone just to be the way they are, which is what most of us most desperately want. Just to be who we are. To be left alone is an exalted gift. And it says to us, that we are willing to enter into the state of simplicity and not try to gain, not for gain's sake, but to float almost vacuously, like a vacuum, like just to live without pretension. In true humility. Because the ego needs conflict in order to be defined. And when we follow the precept, we are less defined. We won't find our name as often in the newspaper. But it's the willingness not to become something, really. Not to constantly try to manipulate life towards our advantage. And so the absence of struggle, the absence of conflict is the way of the heart. It's interesting. And it begins our journey to emptiness. So the precepts are really about not becoming and not doing. And we think they're all about straitjacketing our life. They're not having anything to do with that. So let us be very clear. This is about ease of well-being, lightness of heart, gentleness of spirit, softness of mind, which allows our ability to focus and to get on with the practice, to see things as they are, to be gentle so that we don't have a heaviness and a burden, the absence of paranoia, so it allows us to have a fresh relationship with everything just as it is, not burdened by fear. And so we enter these weeks together. Let us have our posture in place. I don't care, nor should you, about your past. That's over. But let's walk this statement of ethical, perceptual life as far as it will take us, right into the deepest realms of the heart. Can we sit for a minute or two?